The information provided on Dr. Tom Rozell Live by Dr. Tom Rozell, D.C., interview guests, show co-hosts, or substitute hosts is not intended or implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. It is for general information purposes only. Information from this broadcast should not replace the appropriate consultation and examination process by a licensed physician. Always consult your own physician prior to changing any current medical directive or prescription.
Welcome to Dr. Tom Rozell Live. This is Dr. Tom Rozell. Indeed, we're live, and it's a beautiful day outside. Absolutely lovely fall day. Make sure you get outside and enjoy it. That's after you listen to the program. But if you decide to go out a little earlier, put your headset on or pop it into the car and listen, because we have a very interesting program for you, one that unfortunately way too many people have a problem with, and it causes you to limp around and not get up well and forget about going up and down stairs. It can be extraordinarily challenging. What am I talking about? I'm talking about hip pain and degeneration, you know, the breakdown where the doc says, well, we'll watch it for a while and then, you know, we'll replace that hip, and then you go on and, you know, then you end up with the other hip as well. And it's that type of thing. And it can be painful and it can be limiting and it can be quality of life situation. So when I go through something like that, I want to pick the best of the best to talk about, you know, exactly what it is and what can be done about it. And today, none other than those of you who know the professor, Dr. Harlan Browning. Hey, Dr. Browning, good morning. Welcome.
Hey, Tom, good to be here.
Listen, we're talking about a problem that has so many different facets to it. Everything from just throwing out the term, and we'll talk about avascular necrosis, to, you know, obviously the term degenerative joint disease. And there's a lot of ramifications of it, but we're talking about something that people are suffering from exponentially. They have all kinds of triggering mechanisms that cause it, but we're talking about hip degeneration and the sequela ultimately of leg pain. We can end up with a sciatica type of thing. We're talking about low back pain sometimes. It can refer up or down. We can end up with a peripheral neuropathy, if you will. So having said that, let's kind of get into the mesh a little bit. We see people come into the practice at the Rozell Center daily with this type of presentation, at least with pain. So let's walk through it. First, the prevalence of it, you know, relative to how many people are we dealing with throughout the country? And is it something that is growing exponentially, or is it something that is just one of those things that happen?
You know, I certainly think it's probably in the top two of most common joint complaints. Knee is probably right there with it. I think we're seeing a lot more people complain of hip issues. One, because people are living longer, and two, people are becoming more sedentary. And believe it or not, the majority of the folks that I see that have hip problems don't have them because of an injury. They have them because they just don't move enough. And over time, the capsule, all the ligaments that surround that hip just gets contracted, and it changes the way it moves. And then ultimately it starts to degenerate.
People who sit seem to have a propensity for this type of situation, or people who are in a constant stress related condition where they don't do anything else to manage it. There's an argument out there as well that because of societal exposures with different types of infections, whether they're viral infections or things of that nature, that there can be a predilection, if you will, for any joint space in the body, whether it's a shoulder, whether it's a structural system of the spine, or knees or hip. How much of that is related to this type of condition as well?
Well, you know, certainly you need to consider those things. You know, people have prior exposures to, you know, viral infections, Lyme disease, and that sets us up for an immune cascade. The immune system starts to do things differently, and sometimes that involves an autoimmune reaction to the cartilage or the synovial fluid that's in the joint. So, you know, in certainly in some cases, you definitely will see that.
You know, people have a tendency in today's society to run to the store and get a bottle of Motrin, Aleve, any of the NSAIDs, straight up aspirin, when something hurts. And they get addicted, if you will, to that because, you know, a little bit helps sometimes. They feel better. They go on instead of confronting it and affecting it. But the problem, with any of the NSAIDs, if you will, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, is that they compete, if you will, in the joint space, in the cartilage, for the sulfate ion attachment to the joint that helps repair the cartilage. How much of that type of thing, wanting to take something to put the fire out, causes the problem to get to a place where now you can't fix it?
Well, certainly, you know, we see a lot of people on long-term over-the-counter anti-inflammatories. Number one, I think because people can buy it themselves, they assume that it has to be safe and therefore they'll take it. And when, once they start to feel better on it, then it just becomes part of their daily life. It's almost like a you know, a multivitamin for their pain per se. But the problem, like you said, is, many of those NSAIDs compete with sulfite ions, which is kind of the batter in the cartilage. It's what makes up cartilage. So over time, not only does it compete for the health of the cartilage, it actually encourages it to degenerate faster.
You know, there was an interesting article that I read recently in PubMed, which is a very, very solid, very well-researched, peer-reviewed portal, if you will. And I was reading about guys that were taking baby aspirin on an ongoing basis and had been on it for quite some time. And obviously for blood thinning and decrease the inflammatory reactions in the arterial bed. However, what it showed was is that there were increased of arthritic type of conditions and stage that where you started seeing more joint degeneration. I was really fascinated by that because that kind of supported my thought process over a period of time that none of these NSAIDs are any good long term. You know, they were never meant to be used that way. And even some of the natural ones, the salicylic acids, you know, that are out there. What, you know, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, and that's, you know, we're not even mentioning the other thing. I mean, that just, you know, the long-term use puts a, it certainly puts a burden on your liver and your kidney. So if there's any underlying kidney disease or liver disease, then, you know, we're rolling the dice. We might accelerate that process. So I'm just not a big fan of taking these things long-term. It's just, to me, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. I think people do it out of convenience. And maybe because they just get used to having pain, and that's a problem overall. People, they assume that pain is a natural process of the body because they have it, their friends have it. So a lot of times we just brush it off. And by the time we eventually get to a doctor, maybe get that X-ray, then we see that we have a lot of arthritis that probably could have been avoided if we did something earlier on.
So I got a question for you. You've been in this game now a lot of years, and you see all kinds of joint degeneration and breakdown, but relative to the hip, that's the thing that stops people in their lives and it taps them out and so forth, and they've got to do something, and you see the gait patterns that are just so disconcerting. When you look at these things, what would you, if you were going to, you know, just do a grand rounds with a bunch of us, what would you think that the two or three most common reasons that we begin to see joint destruction, do they line up anyway? Is it biochemical pieces? Is it positional pieces? You talked about inactivity, but beyond that?
You know, I probably would say in today's environment, the number one thing would be just being a sedentary lifestyle, which sets us up for a lot of muscle imbalance, meaning that the muscles in the front of our body, which are predominantly flexors, the psoas muscle being one of them, becomes chronically shortened, and that comes at the expense of the muscles that extend our leg, the gluteus maximus being probably the most important one, becomes progressively weaker. Now, that is a scenario where the joint is going to be slightly moved forward in the socket, which is going to cause it to be impinged. And as it pinches the soft tissue, then it starts to break down, and the end product is anything from tearing the cartilage to, you know, frank arthritis of the hip.
Somebody who has a predisposition, particularly women, to an osteoarthritis, osteopenia, osteoporosis type of thing, do you see more people predisposed because of that loss of calcium and bone substance going into joint degeneration, or are they just kind of coincidental to each other?
You know, I think that you can look at those things, but I would actually look more closely at some congenital disorders that you would see. In other words, the way that the hip is designed is not perfectly spherical and it causes an impingement. We call that a cam lesion or a pincer lesion. And certainly the angulation of the femur can be different from different people. We've all heard of bow-legged or knock-kneed. Well, that's significant because we're changing the angle of the leg, which is going to put more shearing force or more stress on the hip or the knee or the ankle. So I look a little bit more towards the anatomical changes than I would say a person having osteoporosis, although that, you know, certainly can affect the outcome.
Well, we talk about later on in the program, I want to talk about the positive negatives of joint replacement. And when they do a total hip, they got to go into the bone. And if the bone is porous, if you will, loss of calcium, there could be some problematics, but we'll touch upon that later on. When you deal with this joint destruction, this cartilaginous breakdown, why one side more than the other sometimes? I mean, there are obviously,
you know, that's
go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's a great question. You know, I probably should have looked this up over the last 25 years, but I haven't. But I would assume that there's probably a greater likelihood of having degeneration on your side of dominance. So if I was to roll a soccer ball at you and you kick it with your right leg, we probably would see it more in that side, but it also can be because of other things. You know, if ladies cross one leg over the other, or the way we sit in a chair. So, you know, there's certainly factors that drive us in a direction to have it on one side versus the other.
I had a patient when in the office the other day, almost grabbed you, and it was a younger person, probably about 37, 38, obviously much younger from my perspective across the board, but an adult by all means. And this person asked me, said, every time that I go out and exercise and I do anything supine where I'm moving my leg in a bicycle format, you know, that type of exercise, pulling the legs up and pushing against resistance or maybe not pushing, he said that he feels a popping in the right foot, or not the right foot, I'm excuse me, the right hip. It just pops, 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 pops. If he changes position slightly, it may not be. So he said, is that a problem? Am I looking at trouble later on? And I said, you may have a shallow socket, a shallow fossa. What else could cause that other than that? Obviously, this person is going to be predisposed to degeneration because he doesn't hit, and if he pushes, pushes, pushes. But what else could cause that?
You can get something called snapping hip syndrome, where it's more or less a tendon moving across the pelvis as well, like the psoas. It could be a tear in the labrum. The labrum is the cartilage insert inside the socket, the acetabulum, that makes the joint deeper, and that gets beat up over time. So if it tears, it can catch and pop. Similar to when a person, you know, tears the cartilage or their meniscus in their knee, they might say, hey, doc, when I straighten and flex my knee, I feel this slight little pop. So that pop is the bone moving across that tear in the cartilage.
My guest today in studio is Dr. Harlan Browning, the professor. We're talking about something that is extremely common, unfortunately, to all of us, hip degeneration and hip pain and leg pain as a result of it. And this Wednesday evening at the Rizal Center for Healing, October the 3rd, you're going to be privileged to hear this man. Many of you know that he's amazing and the information that he puts out there on hip degenerative changes. And all you have to do to make that happen for yourself is give us a call at 703-698-7117. Alternatively, and probably more expediently, go to RozelleCare.com and scroll down. You'll see it. Register, and we'll save a seat for you. But I promise you, you're going to go away with a lot of data, and you'll have a lot of answers to your questions. We're coming up to a break. You're listening to Dr. Tom Rozelle Live. We'll be right back with a whole lot more information for you. Don't go away. Welcome back, everybody. This is Dr. Tom Rozelle. You're listening to Dr. Tom Rozelle Live. It's beautiful outside. I mean, it really is. You know, one of these days I'm going to go out and back. I'm going to sit on my deck. And since we can do most of this stuff now remotely, I'm going to sit there and do the program from there. But I also want to remind you, make sure that you're tuning in to our podcast, Ageless Health with Dr. Tom Rozelle. You can find that by going several different directions. You can go to our website at RozelleCare.com or DrTomRozelle.com or go to RozelleRadio.com, and it'll be all linked there on YouTube, and you can find them all. And so you're going to see the radio program, and you'll see the podcast with some really interesting people. We're trying to make it somewhat provocative and make sure that you have the opportunity to think through things. My guest today, Dr. Harlan Browning, the professor. You will have the opportunity, like none other, this Wednesday evening, the 3rd of November, at the Results Center for Healing in Fairfax, to listen to an amazing presentation. As always, and I say that not lightly, I say that with a tremendous amount of respect, we're going to be talking about hip degeneration and pain and all the things that go along with it, the leg pain that shows up sometimes, the peripheral neuropathy that goes on sometimes, the back pain that's sequel of it, and then it begins to move around and cause all kinds of ugliness. Dr. Harlan, welcome again. Let's get back into it just a little bit. In, offline, we were talking a little bit, and I have an area of interest when it comes to joint spaces and infections, whether fungal infections, bacterial infections, all kinds of weirdness that takes place. There was an article also on periodontal disease and post-surgical joint space degeneration within the hip, which that was one that got me by surprise. I hadn't thought about that because I was always thinking upper body, shoulders, and so forth, neck, and the like. But in fact, in our world where we know that there's a predisposition to every tooth in the mouth to different body parts, that kind of got my attention. But we touched upon it a little bit in the last half. What's your thought process as far as the prevalence of not having cleared up an infection of some sort or living with something, and then it goes to the joint spaces, and the joint spaces that are more traumatic are the ones that, you know, really catch it in the ear, if you will?
Well, truth be told, you know, if we did a viral panel on a bunch of folks, we would find that almost everybody has been exposed to a lot of different viruses. Now, viruses are unique in the way that they can trigger the immune system to do things that inappropriately, or sometimes they just lie dormant. So, you know, as time goes by, like we were talking about off air, you know, you're probably going to see more and more research come forward that shows correlation between, you know, previous exposures. Now, COVID, we were talking about that, you know, being one of them, and other disorders that start to present, you know, joint pain being one of them.
You know, it's craziness. We see so many things in our practice that many other practitioners don't have the opportunity to see, and I'm not sure why that is. It just is. But we end up with all kinds of problems that have been treated, if you will, within the medical arena that fail, and we're ending up in a better place. It's relative to fixing them. And I want you all to know that you can call us today at 888-630-9625. 888-630-9625. That's how you find us here. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about hip pain or leg pain or any other kind of pain. And some people say that I am in the office, but that's neither here nor there. So, Dr. Browning, let's get back into that type of, you know, situation. You said that the majority of us, if we did a panel, We test for tons of different viral infections, and we know that there are viral arthritic conditions. There are bacterial arthritic conditions. Do you think it's something that traditionally, as a community, not our office, because that's where our headspaces go, that is overlooked because they don't realize the significance of the impact and the long-term ability for the body to hide things and protect itself?
Well, you know, I certainly think that if you talk to like an immunologist or a virologist, they would be on board. But for the most part, I think, you know, in the general medical community, we associate certain viruses with certain disorders. So cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr, we think of that as chronic fatigue. Well, there's also, like you said, there's, you know, there's an inflammatory component that could involve the joint. So, again, if we look deeper over time, I bet you we can find a lot of correlations. And we've certainly have seen that with the Lyme pandemic that we've been going through over the last, 20 or 30 years, and certainly the co-infections that are associated with that as well.
Yeah, there's so many different things that come up, particularly in our world, because we have to dig deeper. If somebody comes in with, oh, my hip hurts, you know, too often they're set aside as a bursitis of the hip, and that bursa, that shock absorber, becomes inflamed and irritated, and pretty soon over time you get a calcific bursitis. But that calcium that builds up in there, in the infiltration into all the tissue around it, is can happen. It's not unusual for that to take place. When we get into the second half of the program, I want to talk a little bit about something called oxalate crystals that have a tendency to get into all kinds of things, but particularly joint spaces. And it's something that I've recently learned about, and the effect, the impact that it has. There's so many things that are there. And then I want to talk about the ability to resolve a lot of this. But we're here at 888-630-9625. My guest, Dr. Harlan Browning, the professor, somebody who knows more about joints than any two people should, but it's your opportunity to really learn, and he'll be your presenter this Wednesday night. Don't go away. We'll be right back after some very important messages.
Dr. Tom Rozelle Live continues now on 105.9 FM WMAL.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dr. Tom Rozelle. You're listening to Dr. Tom Rozelle Live. Indeed, we are, and bringing you a very interesting program, one that gets my attention on a regular basis. And we're talking to somebody who really I consider an expert in the area of joint problems, and none other than the professor, Dr. Harlan Browning. Welcome back, my friend. We're talking a little bit about different articles on problems and so forth. There was one that I read recently that was supposedly well done. It came out actually October of last year, 2020. And they were talking about gouty arthritis of the hip and, ultimately having to do, complete arthroplasty on the hip. And it went on to lay out that this is not as uncommon as it was once thought, but it also led to a bilateral avascular necrosis, which can be quite serious because if it's hitting there, it has a tendency to break down. So if we're talking about gout, which is an increase of uric acid crystals within the joint space, all joint spaces, the gouty tophi, the deposition of these, these ugly deposits within the body. Couple questions. One, is it common, or is this something that they're finally understanding? We know that gout goes to the spine, but the big joints, the hips, the shoulders, the knees, what's your thought?
Well, I would certainly say that gout is becoming very common, so much so now that they run advertisements for medication for gout on TV. And I can assure you the pharmaceutical companies would not be spending the money on advertisements for lack of having a consumer to buy it. So it's common, and it's definitively a lifestyle disorder. People eat poorly. They eat too much red meat, too much alcohol, refined carbohydrates, very acidic type diet. And that leads to what you said, the gouty formation of crystals that deposit in our joint spaces.
So, gout is really painful. We think of gout generally as a big toe problem, or maybe it'll hit the knees, we know in our world that's because the acupuncture channel for the liver, which is where this upset comes from, begins on the big toe. So we call it a stagnant problem, a stagnicity, if you will. But once this gouty purine upset forming crystals, uric acid formations in the body gets going, everything hurts. So my brain always goes to the place, how much of an underlying low level predisposing condition because of lifestyle, because of all the garbage that people eat, are we seeing more incidences of this because of that? And how do we distinguish it? How do we determine, your diet is going to destroy your joints. And if it's hitting the big joints, it's going to hit the spine. Now we have immobility. Now we have spines that won't move, and we have other problems that are associated with it. I want to get into that, and I want to then jump into the oxalate patterns that seem to be problematic for so many people.
Yeah, diet is certainly a significant contributor to almost all pain syndromes, and most people don't think about that. And when you ask them about their diet, and I know you deal with this just as much as I do, the the common thing that they will say is it's pretty good. Well, what does pretty good mean? You know, for one person, it can mean, well, I only have two sodas a day. And for another person, it can mean they only have three sodas a day. But the end product is this person is permanently acidic and is inflamed, and they're destroying their intestinal tract, which sets up, you know, an immune response and on and on and on. So they just propagate all these aches and pains they have in their body by eating junk.
You know, I was listening to a webinar this morning when I got up. I usually try to spend the first 20 minutes, half hour of my day learning something that I wasn't aware of or kind of catching up on something else. And this guy was talking about this. He's a physician, PhD, researcher type of guy, a large rehabilitation clinic. And he was talking about the dietary patterns that people get into that they think are good for them. He was talking about heart healthy type of diets. And he was saying that we're seeing more and more arterial disease because of the amount of grains that we eat, particularly breakfast cereals, even going to a place where he pointed the finger at Cheerios. He said, don't touch it. And he said the inflammatory reaction because of the shift into sugars, and the sugar causes that inflammation going backwards a little bit. And then if there's any other predisposition there, he's seeing this plaque, but he extended it from the arterial base to arthritic conditions and joint destruction and joint degeneration. I thought that, I said, wow, you know, they're finally talking about things that I've had an inkling about, you know, for a period of a long time. It just caught my attention. But here's the other piece. Let's talk about oxalates. Oxalates, you know, if you look in the literature, they're talking about kidney stones. Oxalates, if you look in the literature, they may extend it into gallbladder accumulation of stone formation. But there's a lot of information out there that oxalates will get into joints and begin to cause damage. The oxalates are just as destructive, and that was my predisposition, my jump from gout, as the uric acid formation with gout. But oxalates have a tendency to accumulate because of, in our society, according to the literature that I've been reading, is not enough magnesium, that 70 to 80% of people in North America are magnesium deficient, so it doesn't bind the oxalate to get it out of the system, and subsequently it accumulates. What's your thought as it relates to what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, magnesium is hugely important, number one, because it works in synergy with calcium, and most people have an excessive load of calcium in their diet because refined foods are always fortified with it. So unopposed calcium can cause issues. It can cause contraction of muscles. It can cause deposition of calcium in joint spaces. It can cause it depositing in arterial walls. So magnesium is a natural calcium blocker. So and it's not easy to get out of our diet. I'm a big proponent of magnesium across the board for all types of disorders.
But it has to be the right type of calcium as well. Because you can't just most calcium that you buy on the marketplace is very low level or is processed improperly. It doesn't work quite as well. And somebody says, well, what kind of magnesium should I take, to balance things out, right? So, you know, you have magnesium citrates and orotates and aspartates and glycinates, and the list goes on. And there are some that are very predisposed. Let's kind of jump forward. Let's go back into that hip that is just tearing somebody up, and they can't walk well anymore. Now they need something to support them. They can't get up the staircase. When do you make the determination that it can be fixed and this is what has to be done? Let's take the fixed part first. And then at the end of it, I want to talk a little bit about when can it be fixed.
So the things that I look at, when I'm determining what I can help the patient with, is certainly how do the x-rays look? Okay, that's an important factor, but it's not the deciding factor. And I really look at if the person has any impairment, meaning do they have difficulties doing activities of daily living, go up and down the stairs, doing the laundry, standing at the sink. those are more driving factors for me that said there's an urgency here that this person needs to get it under control. Now, having said that, I see x-rays of hips all the time that look horrific, but the person is super high functional and maybe only has minimal pain. So this person is stable. So in those cases, you don't want the ugly looking x-ray to drive that person into an operating room too soon, because in many cases, they won't need it maybe at all.
You know, it's interesting that dilemma shows up on an ongoing basis. There's so many people that come in with horrible looking x-rays, even of the spinal column, and they don't have any pain and they're totally functional. And there are other people that have really good looking x-rays that are in such awful situations that, you know, they're, so that's where you begin to see and have to make the determination. Do we have an inflammatory reaction, going back to everything that people know of today? You know, over the last 18 months, everybody's learned about this cytokine inflammatory reaction. Well, relative to what we're talking about, we're also talking about cytokine reactions, cytokine inflammation predisposed to joint spaces. And there are many different cytokines, you know, or interleukin pathways, interleukin 6 and 10 and 9 and so forth. So if that's the case, can we quiet the inflammatory reaction? Can we balance the muscles? Can we balance the structural things? Because this stuff can come from above down. It can come from, you know, from down up. What's your thought process?
Well, I think the one thing that we haven't touched upon that I'm seeing more and more prevalent, I actually believe it's more a common cause of hip pain than arthritis, is all the soft tissue involvement, meaning we get so much inflammation and contracture of the side of the leg. It's called the iliotibial band. We get shortening of the psoas muscle, or we get, laxity in the ligaments of the sacroiliac joint. All these things will refer pain into the hip. So if we layer all these soft tissue problems on top of a degenerative scenario, then in many cases, it's the soft tissue problem that's propagating it. And the degeneration is the byproduct of that dysfunction over time.
So if we're looking at muscles that are weakened, you know, in the vernacular, we use it in inhibited muscle. It's not working due to something, or muscle that has too much tone, which is usually not the case. It's the antagonist that's problematic more so than anything else. What are the trigger? What are the predispositions? Where can they come from?
The most common would be sitting. When we sit too much, like I touched on before, we just activate those hip flexors and we activate the back muscles. So we get a tightening of some muscles in the front of the body and some muscles in the back of the body. And that comes at the expense of the core muscles, our abdominals getting weaker, and then our glutes getting weaker. The scenario is called lower cross syndrome. But it's a huge reality today. Most of the injuries that I see are from repetitive trauma, like sitting. I don't see as many people getting hurt because they're exercising. I see people get hurt because they're not exercising.
The people who are exercising, if they feel tight, it's because they did too much. But if they get it and do a little bit of rehab or stretching and so forth, it seems to dissipate. Trauma in exercise obviously is problematic, and that can set it up. We mentioned it, but we didn't touch upon it really. Let's talk about the breakdown of a blood supply, if you will, to the joint. And so we're talking about something called avascular necrosis, the loss of blood to the joint space. Now we've got bone destruction because of that. Is that a rare condition, or is it something that is being missed on a regular basis?
You know, full-blown avascular necrosis is probably not super common. We do hear about it. I guess probably one of the most famous examples was Bo Jackson, the football player who hurt his hip. He eventually got avascular necrosis, which means that the blood supply to the hip joint is diminished. The issue is the hip by design is what we call a watershed area. It doesn't have very good blood supply, believe it or not. So anytime we have any kind of compromise to those blood vessels where we restrict even more oxygen and glucose and nutrients, then the bone is going to start to break down. And the necrosis would be just the dissolving and the hardening in, of the bone over time till eventually the person needs a hip replacement.
Dr. Harlan, so here's the million-dollar question. Somebody comes in and they got a bad hip. It's been bugging them for a while. Doc says, you know, this is going to have to be replaced. How often can you take something like that and turn it around and prevent the surgery? And, you know, is it something that is maybe sometimes, or are the odds are that you can do something about it?
Odds are that you can help the majority of these people. The folks that slip through the cracks are the people that have had the hip problem forever and don't do anything about it. And then eventually they show up in your front door at your office and the hip joint is so destroyed that there's really not much left. Now, that's a smaller percentage of folks, but, you know, pain is an indication that there's a problem. So, you know, for those people who are experiencing on again, off again pain, it's probably a good idea to investigate it early on, because if we can slow the process or stop the process, then we're not even talking about hip replacements 10 or 15 years down the road.
Now, we're really talking about a lifestyle condition, something that if you pay attention to, you can prevent a major intervention. Even when you have a hip replacement, as good as they are today, there are risks that are associated with it. And we have to be aware of that. We have to understand that there's, you know, it's never a good thing to wait and say, well, I'm going to get a hip and now I can move, I can do what I want to do and so forth. That hip, even though that technology has soared, is only as good as the substrate, if you will, that it's being attached to. And that's, we talked about a little bit of that earlier, the integrity of the bone formation and everything else that's around it. Another question that you and I see on a regular basis is an imbalance in gait patterns. And often that has to do with the foot itself, the placement of the, what we call the ankle mortise and so forth. Does that have a problem in predisposition to hip pain?
Yeah, well, foot mechanics has a huge impact on anything above it. So you certainly see when a person has maybe a hyperpronation, they're flat-footed, or the person toes in or toes out when they walk, it puts a lot of shearing force on all their joints, the knees, the hips, the low back. So yet to answer your question, yes, if a person has, you know, really bad ankle mechanics, you've got to address it, because if not, you're kicking the can down the road.
You know, this is really a very important subject. It's one that is preventable. And this is what we want to get across. It's Wednesday evening. You'll have the opportunity to really understand what you can do about the problem. We're coming up to a break. You're listening to Dr. Tom Rizal Live. My guest, Dr. Harlan Browning, your presenter this Wednesday evening. Don't go away. We'll be right back after some very important messages.
Washington's Mall, 105.9 FM, WMAL.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dr. Tom Rizal. You listen to Dr. Tom Rizal Live, as you do every Sunday at 11 a.m. on the Eastern Seaboard. Those of you who know the drill that are out in the West Coast, 3 hours difference. And thank you for listening, and make sure you tell everybody about it. And again, we want to remind you that we have a podcast, and it's called Ageless Health with Dr. Tom Rizal. Make sure you check it out. You can find it several different ways. You can find it by going to RozalRadio.com, which is our YouTube channel. They're all there, plus all of our other programs here on Dr. Tom Rizal Live. Additionally, you go to DrTomRizal.com or you go to RozalCare.com. All of them will have links back and forth, and you can find all the information. Remember, we do this on an ongoing basis simply because we want you to have the data, and we want you to have the ability to make your decisions based on fact, not on somebody's agenda. Those of you who are the men and women in service, thank you again. We appreciate it, and trust me, I will get back to you, and as I always have, as quickly as I possibly can with any information. It impresses me how you find our program, but you do, and we want to make sure that we address your concerns ongoingly. My guest today, Dr. Harlan Browning, your presenter this Wednesday evening, November the 3rd, at the Rizal Center for Healing in Fairfax, right off the National Capital Beltway, very close, within about a half a mile, three quarters of a mile. And we'd like to invite you. We'd like to invite you to a very safe environment. We have HEPA filters. We have an environment that not a whole lot is going to be problematic, but this Wednesday evening, you will have the capacity, the ability to learn about your hips and those things that may be a problem in causing you surgical intervention over a period of many years. We don't want that to happen to you. We want to make sure that, you know, you have the ability to shift and to change things ongoingly. Dr. Browning, welcome back. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the process of, you know, what can actually, you know what I want to do beforehand? We do have a couple of calls, and I want to do that because otherwise I'm going to be neglectful. Sylvia, you're calling from Germantown. How can I help you?
Hi, Dr. Rizal. When you mentioned oxalate, it triggered something that I've experienced in the past. I can't take vitamin C daily because I believe it triggered back pain because I have difficulties breaking down oxalate. So I was just curious whether you could discuss that relationship, ascorbic acid.
Well, any kind of ascorbate, you know, any kind of vitamin C has its tolerances that have to be observed for, depends on the patient's and the patient's chemistry. Some people can't handle it. But what it tells me is that it's, there's an imbalance that's going on, and you probably have a magnesium problem associated with it, and it's not so much of the vitamin C. Oxalate foods, when we find somebody like this, the dietary shift, you want to keep your oxalate level very low initially till you start getting the levels down. And we're talking about 50 milligrams per day, which doesn't seem like a whole lot, but it will begin to take the load off. And then magnesium, but particularly in the citrate form. Now, the problem with citrate is that it can be an evacuator. It can cause the bowel to unload. So you have to be real careful in how you step it up. So, you know, maybe you can get away with 250 milligrams, take it up to maybe 400 milligrams, and then move that forward accordingly. But it can be dealt with, and you can get that oxalate level at a lower at a low enough level, then begin to balance foods out and not be overburdened with foods that are too heavily laden with oxalates. Your a lot of your grains, for example, are very heavy in oxalates. Some of you, what would be a good for you dark green vegetable is loaded with oxalates. One of my favorite little fish, sardines, is really, really high in oxalates. So you have to look at what's really driving it, what other things are missing within the dietary patterns, balance that out, and subsequently you can make a difference. But, you know, would love to talk to you and see if we can help you. It's individual. Just saying that I have an oxalate problem really doesn't set it aside and say, okay, you have to avoid all oxalates. You have to avoid vitamin C. There's ways of making that determination. Dr. Browning.
I'd like to, you know, add to that. You know, the breakdown of vitamin C in the body is kind of unique. It's non-enzymatic, so it does lead to oxalates. But one of the things that may help prevent that is when you take a buffered form of ascorbic acid. In other words, it's buffered with, calcium or magnesium or other types of buffering minerals, as opposed to just pure ascorbic acid.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's why I said it's an individual situation. You got to find out what her makeup is, what her deficiencies are, and that can be modified and can be because otherwise the oxalate formations in the body can predispose to joint space. What are you going to cover this Wednesday evening?
Well, we're going to certainly go through a lot of the anatomical concepts. I think when you show people the way that you're designed and certainly give them illustrations of when the design goes wrong, it becomes pretty straightforward how you approach the problem from an engineering standpoint. So we'll talk about design. I'm certainly going to go through and touch on some of the biochemical components of inflammation that cause joint problems and ultimately talk about a lot of the conservative modalities that can be done to fix the problems. Anything from manipulation of the joint to acupuncture to cold laser to nutraceuticals. There's a lot of different things that can help, and what put together in a kind of a formulation, it can be very profound on someone's overall health.
You know, the interesting thing that I want everybody to understand is that we've, knowing that there are other things that need to be supportive of any joint restoration, PRP, protein-rich plasma, can also be usable. And we've actually, we're in the process of putting together a sister company called Aegis Health Medical Regenerative Group, and that will is actually being launched. We'll be doing hip intervention at some point. But that's at the end point. That's at the place where we have a problem. But we have equipment. We have to understand what the underlying triggering mechanisms, whether it's the feet, whether it's the spine, whether it's bacterial formation, viral patterns, and then treat them accordingly. And you can't ignore those things, like our last caller, even oxalate formations. If you have an area that's injured, oxalates have a tendency, a predisposition to go to damaged areas as well and make them actually worse than what they are. I'm excited, you know, for, you know, the program, as I always am. Anytime that you present, people who have heard you speak before know that they're going to get far more than they could possibly even begin to ask for. Join us this Wednesday evening, November the 3rd. And I promise you, a night you will not long forget, particularly if you have hip pain. You can turn this around. Dr. B, thanks a lot. I'll see you tomorrow. And
yep, I'll see you tomorrow.
Everybody else, remember, we do this on an ongoing basis for one reason only, and simply this. We love you all.